This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hi there, listeners in Radioland. Tonight you're in for a special occasion.
The December editorial in the science journal Nature says, "The weird weather just keeps on coming." Nobody can dispute that. Europe had its Lucifer heat wave last summer. The deadly trials of California keep on coming. It snowed heavily in the Sahara last week. And Australia is wildly hot, with fire risks beyond the highest level.
Now, we also have numerous fire dangers ongoing across South Australia, including a catastrophic fire danger for the Eastern Eyre Peninsula, as we have very hot and dry conditions. Some places are set to soar towards the mid-40s.
A listener in Maryland wrote me to say the temperature went from below zero Fahrenheit to a shirt sleeve 60 degrees within 24 hours. The mayor of Boston pointed to places that never flooded before, that went under with the bomb cyclone called Grayson. He called it rising seas from global warming right on national TV.
When you've been through the sort of weather we've all endured these last 7 weeks, there's some gratification in knowing that it's been more than just bad weather.
Another snow megadon hit Spain, while the Netherlands was warmer than Rome. It's all upside down. In my opinion, the weather has gone off the rails. The climate shift is showing itself about 30 years earlier than expected. It's still hard to prove that our current strange weather is due to climate change, using the time-tried tools available to science. I will talk to an American expert in meteorology to find out what we know and what we don't. Then we travel over to the UK to ask the question, is the unheard of warming in the Arctic disrupting weather further south, where hundreds of millions of people live? Now, I can make all this sound more frightening and urgent. I feel that way, and many of us do. But in this show, we step back to check our fears with the most solid science we can find. That's what we do here on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
A breakthrough in medical research can be great news. A breakthrough in climate science can be bad news. On December 19, 2017, an editorial in the premier journal Nature reveals extreme weather explicitly blamed on humans for the first time. Dr. Thomas R. Knutson is a research meteorologist for the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, better known as NOAA. Actually, Tom works in a NOAA operation called the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. He's written a lot of papers on climate science, including extreme weather events. Tom Knutson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We were set to talk a week ago, but ironically, your lab was closed due to a rare and extreme storm that struck New England in the first week of January. What the heck is a bomb cyclone?
Oh, I think they're just referring to one of these cyclones that we have along the East Coast that deepens very quickly. And so, meteorologists sometimes come up with names to describe a phenomenon they're seeing. A researcher years ago came up with that term to just describe a cyclone which was dropping in its central pressure very quickly, as this recent storm did. So it's just a sort of a term to describe a bit of what's going on in the atmosphere in general terms.
Well, since a cyclone and a typhoon and a hurricane, they're all the same sort of storms, but in different parts of the world, I think. Is it fair to say that a hurricane just hit New England in January, and isn't that kind of unusual?
Well, they're not exactly the same. The hurricanes are different from what we call the typical winter storms. Hurricanes form in the tropics, and they have a particular type of vertical structure in the atmosphere, in their temperature fields and their wind fields. Whereas because they are basically being driven by the heat that's being released as water vapor turns into liquid water and precipitation, whereas these wintertime storms, the energy from those is often coming from strong temperature contrasts that you have, say, near a jet stream. So these are different. Wintertime extratropical storms are different from hurricanes in their structure and so forth, so we wouldn't want to get them confused. And this storm that we had was more of the extratropical storm variety. It wasn't really the typical, it wasn't a hurricane that we would experience more in the hurricane season, something developing and coming out of the tropics.
So at NOAA, you help with the public information website about global warming and hurricanes, and people always want to know if global warming is making hurricanes worse. So before we get to your new science, I just want to ask, what is the scientific answer to that so far?
Well, global warming is having some impact on hurricanes, in particular on the types of impacts that we have from hurricanes. For example, anthropogenic climate change is causing some of the observed sea level rise that we're seeing. So global sea level has been rising according to our historical records and also paleo records. So as the sea level rises, that all other factors equal, that will lead to greater storm surge levels for whatever storms happen. So that's an example of a way in which human-caused climate change is exacerbating impacts from hurricanes. We also think that because there's more moisture in the atmosphere, in a warmer atmosphere, that's leading to higher rainfall rates out of hurricanes as the climate warms. It's very difficult to look at the past data on hurricanes and actually detect these changes that we're expecting, for example, the changes in precipitation. We're also expecting some increase in average hurricane intensity in a warmer climate. But these things are very difficult to see in the historical records because of data quality issues and so forth. So it's not the same as, say, for global mean temperature, where we have a very good record of the anomalies going back more than a century, and we see this very clear rising trend, which we're able to attribute with considerable confidence to anthropogenic forcing. That's the situation for global mean temperature is a lot different than for hurricanes. For hurricanes, we think that anthropogenic climate change is having an impact on rainfall rates and intensities and so forth, but we still cannot really detect that clearly in the data to date. So it's a little bit different degree of confidence that we're dealing with.
Right, and you and your colleagues just published a paper showing that the record hot year of 2016 could not have happened without human greenhouse gas emissions. Why is your paper kind of a breakthrough in the way scientists can talk to the public about climate change?
Yes, and just to clarify, our statement that this record global mean temperature anomaly in 2016 was not possible without anthropogenic forcing, that's according to the CMIP-5 models. So we're using the collection of climate models that's available from various institutions around the globe in order to make this assessment statement that we came up with. We're not stating unequivocally that it was impossible in any possible sense. We're saying that if it's not possible, according to our analysis, to generate such a large annual mean, global mean temperature anomaly using existing climate models. So I think what's happening is that global mean temperature has been continuing to rise. It's been rising, of course, since the late 1800s, but it's continuing to rise even in the past few years, and we're reaching these new record high levels. As global mean temperature continues to rise, it becomes more and more unusual compared to the type of variability that we would expect in a hypothetical climate where humans were not involved. We use models to estimate what that hypothetical climate would be like, the climate without humans. And what we're saying in this study is that these global mean temperature anomalies are now sufficiently large that they're well outside of the range that we can simulate with models where we're trying to simulate climate fluctuations without anthropogenic forcing. In fact, if you take the largest internally generated global mean temperature anomaly from 36 existing climate models and multiply it by factor 2, the observed record in 2016 would still be larger than that level. So there's some, the 2016 anomaly was considerably higher than what we can simulate in our climate models, which, again, is the models are not, should not be viewed as the absolute truth. We use them to make inferences about what's going on in the climate system, and that's what we infer based on current models and these very and this new record temperature in 2016.
And you've been tracking record heat for some time, including assessments of 2015 and 2016. What are your thoughts about where 2017 will fit in?
Well, I think that there are several groups around the world that track global mean temperature, and they normally come out in January with their final assessment for the year. I think I noticed on the web that one group has already released their report saying that it was second place. 2017 was in second place. So we'll see how the other groups, what the other groups report over the course of the next few weeks. And that would be my expectation, 2017, probably a little, not quite as warm as 2016, but still very high, perhaps a second place year or so.
And this record heating, due to our greenhouse gas emissions, we think it's not just global, but also regional. Another study in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society looked at heat waves in Southeast Asia in 2016, and the boiling heat there set records, killed hundreds of people, broke the grid with air conditioning demands. Tom, how do regional heat records fit into the global picture?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think if you're looking for evidence of human influence on climate, it's best to look at very large spatial averages and also very long time records. So when we look at global mean temperature, so we're averaging over the whole globe, and that averaging over the whole globe helps us to sort of enhance sort of the signal to noise that we're seeing. And also, if we look at very long records, then we can more clearly separate, see a long-term trend and attempt to separate it from the types of year-to-year variability that we have in the record. So when you go down to a regional scale, especially if you go down to just, say, a small region, there's going to be more noise in the data. And so you can set bigger records. And in fact, looking, for example, at temperature records over the United States in recent years, there's still many cold records being set. It's the ratio. What we're seeing is that there are more hot records being set than cold records, by something like a ratio of about 2 to 1. So that's important to keep in mind. Then that every third, roughly speaking, every third record temperature we're going to experience will be a cold record, and that's something we expect to happen as the climate continues to warm. As we expect it to over the coming decades, it's going to become more and more difficult to set cold records. It already appears to me to be virtually impossible to set an annual mean, global mean cold record. That's because of this effect of the averaging over large spatial scales and looking at long time scales. In fact, the last time we set a cold record for annual mean, global mean was back around 1910.
But previously you did publish a paper, Prospects for a Prolonged Slowdown in Global Warming in the Early 21st Century. That's not what most of us are expecting. Why did you look into that?
Yes, well, if you look at the history of global mean temperature since, say, the late 1800s, it has not gone up as just a straight linear trend over time, but it seems to have gone up in almost like a series of steps. So we had an early 20th century warming from around 1900 up to around 1940, and then from 1940 to 1970, we had some type of pause where the Earth's climate didn't warm at all. And then from the 70s on up to around 1998 or so, it again warmed rapidly. And then from 1998 up until a few years ago, things appeared to have paused again. And then, of course, the warming seems to have picked back up as we've had these most recent records. So what we're trying to do is as climate scientists, is understand what has been the cause for these pauses in warming and so forth. For example, the lack of warming from 1940 to 1970, and how about the apparent slow rate of warming from 1998 up through, say, 2013 or so. So we look into that. We think that these pauses, again, we're not talking about the overall trend. It's very clear what's going on there, and according to the climate model simulations, that's largely being driven by anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. But what about the steps, the pauses? So that's what we were getting at with this study. We were wondering, could we have another pause here at the beginning of the 21st century that would be something like from 1940 to 1970? Would that even be possible? And so we looked at a model from our laboratory that produces more internal climate variability than any other of the current climate models that we looked at. So it's sort of an extreme case of how much internal climate variability we could have. And we asked, let's assume we have some kind of rare temporary cooling event just due to natural variability starting around the year 2000. Let's take the biggest one possible from a 5,000-year simulation of this most variable model and take that as an example. So what we were doing is sort of stress testing. We were saying, how would it even be possible for us to have another pause in global warming like 1940 to 1970? And based on our analysis, we said, yes, it may be possible. A couple of things need to happen. First, the climate models need to be a little bit too aggressive in their overall warming sensitivity, that's something which is still uncertain. The researchers are still arguing about exactly how sensitive Earth's climate is to a buildup of greenhouse gases. So what if the models tend to be a bit overly sensitive? And also, what if we had coincidentally one of these really strong internal variability cooling events beginning around the year 2000? It's the strongest one that you could have in a 5,000-year long simulation. If you put all that together, we found that yes, you could in a very rare case you could perhaps have a cooling even now that might extend out a couple of decades. But it doesn't seem to be what's actually happening. We do seem to be just going back onto this warming trend that we seem to have been on since around the 1970s.
Yeah, it seemed like in the paper your conclusion was that it could happen, but the odds were pretty low.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what the point of the paper was, really, to try to say whether it could happen, and if so, what would the chances of it happening be? And we assessed it as being pretty low. But I think it's fascinating, you know, we were to look at how global mean temperature evolves and to try to understand exactly what kind of trajectory are we going to have going forward from now? Is it going to be, are we going to continue with a sort of the same relatively rapid rate of warming that we've had since the 1970 or so? Is it going to be somewhat more moderated warming rate? Those are the kinds of questions we were trying to address with this study.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from New Jersey. We are talking with climate science with Dr. Thomas R. Knutson, a research meteorologist at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. Tom, you recently returned from a meeting of the American Meteorological Society. Did you present there?
Yes, I did. I had two presentations at the meeting. One was addressing the question of whether there was any human influence on these three very damaging hurricanes that we had during the 2017 season, Hurricane Harvey, Irma, and Maria. The second paper was, again, reporting briefly on our analysis of the 2016 record global temperatures, but also on some new work that we have that's under review at Journal of Climate, looking at precipitation trends and whether we're seeing evidence for anthropogenic influence on precipitation trends around the globe.
You know, a couple of decades ago, meteorologists and media weathermen in particular downplayed the link between climate change and the weather they were reporting. They'd talk about floods, fires, and storms. It's still going on ABC or NBC News. They talk about extremes, weather extremes, extreme precipitation events even, and don't mention climate change. I'm wondering if the science that you've just brought out will help change that.
Well, in the science community, we're continuing to study this problem of extremes, weather and climate extremes, and the relationship between weather extremes and anthropogenic climate change. Now, I mentioned, for example, the local temperature records where it now appears that in recent decades over the U.S. that there are twice as many hot records being set as cold records. So that's an example of how the warming, long-term warming trend in the climate system is altering the odds of certain types of extreme events. In that case, it's the odds of temperature extremes. We also are seeing evidence in the data for increases in precipitation extremes around the globe. That's, for example, how much precipitation falls in a 2 or 3 day period around in various locations around the globe. In the areas where we have sufficient data to actually look for this change, we're seeing evidence of increases in extreme precipitation. And climate scientists, for example, in the IPCC report, are concluding that it's likely that some of this enhancement of extreme precipitation is being driven by anthropogenic climate change, though we're not as confident about the anthropogenic influence on precipitation extremes as we are, say, on temperature extremes. And then if we look at some other types of extremes, which we're very interested in, like drought and flooding and hurricanes and things of that nature, then we're really even less confident, I think, particularly much less confident than we are for the case of temperature extremes. So it really depends. It depends on what variable you're considering, because there's some of the variables, especially those that are most closely linked to temperature, are the ones where we're climate scientists are able to make a bit more confident statements about the linkage between anthropogenic climate change and the occurrence rates of extremes. But there are other types of weather and climate phenomena occurring which are more difficult to, where this linkage is much more difficult to make for various reasons. It may be because of lack of adequate data over long enough time scales and large enough spatial scales. In some cases, it may be because anthropogenic climate change is not really influencing the particular event in question to a substantial enough degree to actually make it make such a change apparent to us in the data. So we don't expect everything. Well, we do expect climate change to have some influence on a lot of different aspects of the climate system. But the question is, how strong will that influence be? Will it be strong enough so that we can look at multi-decadal to century-scale records and actually detect, clearly see the change in the data? Or will the change be somewhat more muted and more difficult to detect in the historical records? And I think the answer to that question is going to be different. It's going to depend on exactly what phenomenon you're considering.
Well, I'll definitely have to keep that in mind. And I do note, though, that the December editorial in Nature says the weird weather just keeps on coming. And they cite the Lucifer heat wave last August, big hurricanes, California drought and fires. And just the beginning of this new year, we had rare snows in the Sahara, and Australia is roasting with heat beyond belief. Right there in America, people were whipsawed between Arctic chills and mild temperatures. I have to say, as a non-scientist, I mean, simple citizens going through all this, it feels like we cracked through some kind of barrier where weather crazy's the new normal. Is that too extreme a statement, or do we still have to keep our scientific reticence in talking about these things?
Yes, I think we have to be careful. I think there are ways in which, as climate scientists, we can look at particular phenomena and look at the data, look for evidence of anthropogenic influence on events of the particular type that we're seeing. And as I mentioned before, in some cases, I think that climate science is able to make a relatively confident case that anthropogenic climate change is having an influence on extremes. And again, I would point to things, for example, surface temperature extremes as being an example, and precipitation extremes, or as sea level is rising, we're having more occurrences of sort of nuisance flooding, for example. So certain types of extremes where we are expecting the anthropogenic climate change to have an influence on the occurrence rate, or perhaps the intensity of these extremes. But there are other types of extremes where I would say sort of the jury, let's say the jury is still out. There are a lot of complicating factors, confounding factors. For example, if you're looking at for changes in flooding frequency, but one of the confounding factors is that we've built a lot of dams and flood control infrastructure over the years, and so that's going to have some influence on stream flow records that we would use to look for flood frequency. So you have to account for other types of influences that can create changes that we might see in the data. And that's part of the part of our work as climate scientists, is try to account for various possible competing influences that could explain changes in occurrence of certain types of extremes, and then try to tease out what is the part of that change that is more likely to be due to anthropogenic climate change, and are there other parts of the change which maybe can be explained by some other type of non-climate change factor.
Well, as we wrap up, I've got two quick questions for you. First of all, what is the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory? And then, what are you working on next?
Yes, the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory is a research laboratory which is funded by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And GFTL's mission is to construct Earth system models of the Earth's weather and climate, and to seek a deeper understanding of the causes of climate change and climate variations. That's our, in a general sense, our lab's mission. And within that, my work involves a couple of things, looking at the relationship between hurricanes and climate change that we discussed earlier, and also the problem of what we call detection and attribution of climate change, which is basically trying to look at what's actually happening in observed records, especially long-term records, and to try to say something about whether the changes we're seeing are being caused by human-induced climate change, or are they just natural fluctuations. And to do that, this involves both using observed data and also using models and trying to understand the reasons for the changes we're seeing. And of course, we're expanding this work beyond just looking at global mean temperature to look at other types of phenomena of interest to scientists, to the public, and to policymakers, such as changes in extreme events. So it's I think it's very interesting work, and I'm pleased to be involved in it.
We've been talking with Dr. Thomas R. Knutson, a research scientist at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory, which, as he says, is part of NOAA. His latest paper is titled CMIP, Model-Based Assessment of Anthropogenic Influence on Record Global Warmth During 2016. Find links to the science we've been talking about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tom, thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. For me, one important takeaway from this talk with Dr. Tom Knutson is for all of us to avoid a common pitfall. We know that climate is the stage where many other acts and actors take place. A shift in climate affects so many things, from acidity of the ocean to survival of plants and animals, our economy, maybe war. But when talking with others, we have to avoid the tendency of proclaiming that everything that happens is because of climate change. There are other potent forces at work in nature, you know that, and world systems have been variable for several billion years. That is why we have science, to check our possible illusions against reality. Let's be strong and sure of those things that are strong and sure, and leave room for doubt and limitation on other things. That way, the public will not be confused and disillusioned when a small part of a climate belief system turns out to be wrong. Let a complex world be complex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
America just went through a punishing round of extreme winter weather. First the bomb cyclone hit, then an Arctic vortex swung down with bone-chilling temperatures. We know the climate has been destabilized year-round. Behind the scenes, scientists are asking, is a rapidly warming Arctic creating winter chaos further south? Can sea ice levels predict a month of cold in northern China? What about North America or Europe? Dr. Edward Hanna is a scientist who knows what we know so far. He is a professor of climate science and meteorology in the College of Science at the University of Lincoln in the UK. With over 100 peer-reviewed papers published, Hanna was also a contributor to the 2013 assessment by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But we'll be talking mostly about a paper Professor Hanna co-authored in 2015 titled, The Melting Arctic and Mid-Latitude Weather Patterns, Are They Connected? Edward Hanna, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for inviting me on.
What are your thoughts, Edward, about the swings of extreme weather recently in the United States and Canada? Is there an Arctic connection?
Well, certainly there's been a clustering of extreme cold winter events in the eastern U.S. in the last few winters, and I believe this is a result of a more frequently north-south meandering jet stream conditions in the atmospheric circulation over that part of the U.S., which at times appears to be influenced by the recent strong warming in the Arctic that's been occurring over the last few decades.
As your team reported in that paper, climate science requires longer periods of time, decades at least. Are these big changes in the Arctic just too young to study well?
Well, it's certainly true that in climate change terms, the really strong phase of Arctic warming has only really been occurring since the 1990s. But nevertheless, that is now almost about 20 years or so of record. And we could really do with another 10 years or so to consolidate that in terms of having a minimal observational database. But the changes are very big in the Arctic. So there are some extreme events, of course, that we've been analysing. So it's quite interesting.
To set the stage for us, how much has the Arctic climate changed?
Well, the Arctic warming has been approximately, well, at least double the overall global warming over the last 2 to 3 decades. So we're talking about temperatures going up by at least a couple of degrees over large parts of the Arctic for a good part of the year. In tandem with that, we've also seen very significant reductions in the sea ice of about 13% per decade, averaged over the last 3.5 decades or so in late summer in terms of the coverage of the sea ice extents, and the actual sea ice volume has gone down by something like 3/4 over the same time period in late summer. So these are big changes.
Yeah, huge changes. When I was a child, I never thought that any of that would be possible. I thought the Arctic would be frozen over, and that's just the way it was.
Well, certainly, in one sense, we're very lucky that we have the equipment and observations to be able to monitor these changes. Of course, there have been changes before in the Arctic a very long time ago, but in terms of what's been happening certainly over the last few decades to last few centuries, these are really quite unusual changes.
I know that my listeners want to hear about their own weather problems. But the connection to sea ice and cold spells might be easier to explain for Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and northern China. Would you take a few minutes, if needed, and explain what your research found out about that region?
So in our 2015 Journal of Climate paper, this was really a synthesis review, but there's a big collective body of work that indicates that losses of Arctic sea ice in the eastern part of the Arctic, that's in the north of the Russian-Siberian coast, so areas like the Kara Barents Seas, this can really disturb at times the atmospheric circulation over that eastern part of the Arctic. So what this appears to do is to at times strengthen high pressure over Siberia and northern parts of Russia and actually change the configuration of the jet stream further to the east of there. So in other words, over the coast of eastern parts of Asia, of China and Japan and Korea, those areas that have seen some quite severe cold, snowy winter outbreaks in the last few winters. So the actual physics of what happens is still open to some degree of question, but there's a large number of computer model simulations and observational-based studies that do suggest that there is a connection from the north coast of Siberia all the way across to the east coast of Asia, and it can promote, at times, some severe cold wintry outbreaks.
In your 2015 paper with James Overland and others, you acknowledge there is a controversy surrounding this new science. So what is the debate?
So there's certainly, three or four years ago, there was the idea that mid-latitude changes, changes in severe weather events that hundreds of millions of people in Northern Hemisphere, densely populated land masses, North America, Europe and Asia, the changes in the jet stream which can affect extreme weather events in these regions may be mostly due to tropical causes or meteorological causes rather than Arctic causes. So there were two schools of thought, really, and there still are to a certain extent, although I think that's been reconciled a bit since a few years ago, that basically there can be changes from factors such as El Nino affecting mid-latitudes. But a few years ago, I think there really, in particular, there was one school of thought that really said that all of those changes or most of the mid-latitude extreme weather changes are forced from the tropics and not from the polar regions. The other school of thought said the reverse, that the mid-latitude extreme weather changes are forced just from the polar regions. And so there was a bit of a polarized, quite a polarized divide between these two groups of scientists. So I think that's been somewhat reconciled over the last few years. And of course, there's still some difference of opinion. Of course, both factors are likely to be important in various points in space and time.
Yes, a year ago I discussed this problem with the American climatologist Judah Cohen. He works with a private firm that provides weather forecasts for big institutions, including the military. And Cohen agreed with what I found in your paper, that at some level it matters not so much that we can prove 100% that the Arctic changes are reshaping our weather, but that we can use the observations of the connections to make better forecasts. Would you talk about that?
Well, certainly, ultimately, I think climate scientists have the same goal of being able to improve predictions of or computer model simulations of climate change and variability going into the future. So, ultimately, it doesn't particularly matter how the system works. The most important thing is to improve our understanding of that system so that we can improve our response to how the climate changes. So, from a pragmatic point of view, clearly the forecasting elements are a very important one.
Let's move back to North America, where many of my listeners live. Edward Hanna, what has been observed there when it comes to relationships between a warming Arctic and mid-latitude weather?
Well, certainly over the last few winters, as we discussed before, there have been severe cold outbreaks all the way down the east coast going into parts of the central U.S. and up into eastern parts of Canada, which have resulted from having a more north-south aligned jet stream over the U.S. at those given times. And it does seem that there is some evidence, certainly from work based on observations, that a warmer Arctic, it can disturb at times the jet streams so that you get these more frequent severe cold wintry outbreaks, which is a bit counterintuitive because these wouldn't necessarily have been expected with a traditional global warming theory. But certainly the changes in the Arctic have been so large that they sprung surprises from the observations, or at least that seems to have been the case.
Yes, as you say, last January, Dr. Cohen predicted another colder winter this year for 2017-18 here in North America, even though the world as a whole continues to get warmer. I mean, it's sizzling down in Australia right now. It seems unfair that any group could get colder winters out of global warming. What is going on there?
basically, if you have a more north-south moving air masses, then you can exchange air masses between the Arctic and mid-latitudes more frequently. Not all the time, but more frequently. That's the important note. So it does mean that there is a tendency to, or probability of getting these cold air masses moving further south than perhaps has previously been the case. So ironically, as the world gets warmer, remember that the warming is particularly focused in the Arctic region, then at least in the medium term for a few decades, then you can actually get more frequent cold winter spells in certain regions, even though obviously the whole planet is warming over that time period.
That's just what the climate deniers want to hear. Well, we'll have to accept reality, I think. So what about the extreme powerful storms on the Atlantic coast of North America, including one that just hit in January with cyclone-force winds? Are there connections there to the Arctic, possibly?
Well, certainly there have been some studies, for example, of Hurricane Sandy a few years ago, which hit the New York region in October 2012, that the path of that may have been influenced by unusually high air pressure over the Greenland region, which in turn is likely to have been linked to strong warming in Greenland, being a key part of the Arctic. So the jury's still out on how these events will change in the future, because there's big issues with computer model simulations and so on. But there's certainly a possibility that hurricane tracks at times could be affected, although further studies are needed.
And the hardest case to understand is right where you are in Europe. If winter delivers a superstorm to Europe, can we ever say that global warming caused it?
Well, of course, you can't say that global warming causes one particular event. It's more a change in body of events, or the severity of these events. And, of course, superstorms are unlikely to affect the whole of Europe, because the weather is so tremendously variable here. But what I would say is that Europe is very sensitive to slight changes in jet stream strength or position, particularly northwest Europe, UK, and also going slightly further east into Scandinavia. So you don't need that much of a change in the jet to cause potentially quite a severe change in weather conditions over densely populated parts of Europe.
And was the greatest storm for hundreds of years. Starting off at sea, the storm blazed a 1,000-mile trail of destruction. Over 2,000 people were killed and thousands more left homeless. The North Sea coastlines of Britain and Holland were decimated. One after another, communities were ripped apart and people drowned in their beds.
On YouTube, I just watched an old TV documentary on the Big Freeze in the UK. That was in 1963, when roads and railroads were obliterated by deep snow that lasted well over a month. So I guess it's obvious there have been severe storms in the UK and Northern Europe for a very long time.
There have, although 1963 was a truly exceptional severe winter in certainly in most of the UK. So it was the coldest winter in England for about 200 years or so, at least. So that really was quite exceptional. And in fact, I doubt we would get another 1963 type event nowadays, because the base climate has changed. So severe winters, even if you get the same meteorological precursor conditions, will be less severe than they were at that time.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question. Do you think the winter weather has changed in Northern Europe and the UK, say, since 1985?
Oh, yes. I mean, I grew up around that time. I was going to school then, and I remember well several severe winter episodes in the 80s, so 81, 82, 87, and actually 91. Not the whole winters, but parts of those, the likes of which we didn't really see again until 2009-10 and 2010-11. But in general, since about 1990, with the exception of a couple of years in the mid-90s, I can speak mainly for the UK, because that's the region I'm most familiar with, but the winters have been notably mild, except for these two more recent winters in 09-10 and 10-11.
And then there's the case of what was called Snowmageddon, the mega snowstorm that hit eastern North American cities in 2010. Has anybody found any climate connections to that one?
I'm not really a research specialist so much on that, but I mean, what I would say is that this is part of a pattern of events that is linked to these cold Arctic air outbreaks with a more north-south winding jet stream, which appears to be influenced at times by Arctic warming. So I believe there probably is, although, again, it would be very dangerous to attribute one event to climate change or Arctic warming.
And there is more water vapor in a warmer atmosphere, so we are likely to get more extreme precipitation events, whether it's snow or rain.
Absolutely. It does depend, though, on the how the jet stream responds as well. So it's not just having the warmer atmosphere. That is clearly a factor. But how the jet stream actually changes in position and strength will have regionally a much more major effect on the precipitation.
And the effect was total paralysis. Farmers had stopped thinking about producing to survive. It was now a question of surviving to produce. For villages and farms all over southern England, the telephone was the only remaining link with the rest of the world.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. From the University of Lincoln, UK, we're talking with Professor Edward Hanna. We all want to know whether the unheard of changes in the Arctic could disrupt the climate further south, where hundreds of millions of people live and feel that they're experiencing weird winter weather. Edward, in 2016, you, Jennifer Francis, and James Overland, and a half dozen other distinguished scientists published another paper in Nature Climate Change. The title was Nonlinear Response of Mid-Latitude Weather to the Changing Arctic. What was the focus there?
Well, the main point from that work, I think, is that there was no one-to-one cause and effect. So, in other words, what we tried to do was to actually reframe the debate between these two schools of thought that I've described previously about the people who think that, or the scientists who think that all the mid-latitude weather comes from the tropics, and the other group of scientists who thinks it comes from the poles. In reality, there's a large range of drivers, and it's more a question of how the Arctic influences the mid-latitudes weather rather than whether it does. And various influences have varying degrees of importance in space and time. But basically, you can have jet stream patterns, even the same pattern. It may not always arise due to the same type of driving effects that are actually forcing that. So we tried to reframe the debate and try to reconcile these two schools of thought.
I know you're also a specialist in glacial melting. Are scientists seeing a speed up of freshwater meltwater into the Atlantic from Greenland?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly, the Greenland ice sheet is currently losing about 250 billion tons per year of ice mass, averaged over the last decade or so. So that's been fairly reliably determined from satellite data and computer model simulations, as well as surface data. And that mass loss has tripled since the early 90s.
James Hansen, as you know, is one of several scientists suggesting that Greenland meltwater is responsible for a cold blob in the ocean south of Greenland. First, do you agree? And if so, could that change also affect the storm track into the UK and Scandinavia?
There's certainly a potential factor in North Atlantic sea surface temperature patterns affecting the jet stream. There's been a fair bit of work on this, and certainly the other thing that's noticeable is also that one of the cool spots in global warming is this area, as you mentioned, just south or southeast of Greenland, which has not really warmed over the last couple of decades, even perhaps cooled for ever so slightly. So we don't really understand enough yet about the changes in the deep water conveyor belt, as it's popularly known, part of the ocean circulation, because we've not been monitoring it in enough detail for sufficiently long. But certainly there could be an effect there.
As your paper notes, there were, quote, record floods in the United Kingdom in 2007, 2012, and 2013-14. When does a chain of extreme weather events go beyond coincidence?
So, again, we do have two issues, I think. One is the relatively short observational record, only about 20 years of the really strong Arctic warming. The other one is that depending on the severity of the event you're looking at, there's barely any events to be able to tell whether or not, or statistically assign significance to any changes. So I think there's a variety of lines of evidence that need to be taken here to look at events of different degrees of severity. So you're looking at perhaps how the, not just the exceptionally severe events, but the more more moderately severe events because there's more of a body of those events, how they're changing over time. And then there's also tricks you can do with computer model simulations to simulate changes in mean climate as well and look at how extreme events are changing there. So it's a number of lines of evidence, but certainly there is a good point in the question that if you just take the most extreme records from a relatively short observational record, then it's not enough by itself to be able to statistically say with the required confidence whether that's definitely due to climate change. But there's other things that can be done to tackle the problem.
Regarding weather connections to sea ice, is it, Edward, the total global sea ice or even all the coverage across the Arctic of sea ice, or can smaller changes in smaller ice bodies trigger big things in larger areas?
Well, I certainly think that there are nonlinear cause and effects. So there are certain geographic regions, such as the Kara Barents Seas, northeast of Scandinavia and north of Siberia, so that region just north of the Russian coast that I spoke about earlier. Also the Labrador Sea, just west of Greenland, Baffin Bay regions. These seem to be regions where sea ice changes may have quite sensitive effects on the overlying atmospheric circulation and potentially on jet stream conditions further south.
Please tell us, Edward, about the World Meteorological Organization's Polar Prediction Project. What is it and how is it going?
So this is basically, it's a program of the WMO. I'm not directly involved. I'm involved in some of their other programs called CLIC. But the polar prediction program is really trying to improve predictability of Arctic environmental and meteorological conditions on timescales from hours to seasons, I believe. And they've got a number of workshops and fora and discussion and so on and collaborations internationally. They try to achieve that.
Now, the paper we've been talking about, The Melting Arctic and Mid-Latitude Weather Patterns, Are They Connected?, was published in 2015, and no doubt that was based on earlier research. So now it's 3 or 4 years on. Is the science of these connections getting more developed?
It's frustrating from one point of view because we have a few more years of data, but still not enough to be able to ascribe statistical significance to trends. But more data is always useful. I think there is a bit more understanding of some of the potential mechanisms in terms of the meteorological dynamics. So in other words, if you have melting of sea ice and strong Arctic warming in local regions, how that might potentially affect the jet stream further south. However, there's big problems with computer model simulations because different models give different results under different conditions, and there's a lot of disagreement between the models and a lot more work to be done in developing the ability of the models to simulate certain physical processes over the Arctic. For example, high pressure blocking over Greenland is still quite poorly represented in many computer models, and that seems to be a key part of the Arctic mid-latitude link over the North Atlantic region, which affects downstream on Europe, for example. Also, there is some lack of full understanding on the theoretical meteorology, on the meteorological dynamics of how the energy gets transferred around the atmosphere in terms of different waves, which can potentially transfer energy from the Arctic to the mid-latitudes or vice versa. So there's a lot more work to be done.
Sounds like we're going to have to be a little careful with the big newspaper headlines that just draw direct connections as though it's all fact.
Oh, absolutely. But I think that as long as we're up front and we lay out the uncertainties as they are, I think it's such a potentially high impact area of science, obviously in terms of Arctic changes potentially affecting mid-latitude extreme weather conditions, that it's one that really needs to be explored further, and people just need to be aware of the possibilities of what scientists are doing and what we think and what's happening.
Good point. Well, look, the 2015 paper had two fundamental conclusions for me, and the first says, quote, current synthesis suggests that there will be no net mid-latitude cooling, only a potential for severe events. Can you expand on that a little?
Well, I think ultimately global warming will win out over these propagation of cold air masses down to mid-latitudes. So that doesn't go against the idea that you can get short to medium term these cold air outbreaks, but ultimately the main driving force climatically is global warming, and of course the ice will be gone, the sea ice in summer most likely or late summer within 2 or 3 decades. And I think there will reach a point at which perhaps some of the disturbances that we're seeing may longer be so active, and global warming will win out everywhere in the end. But we're talking at least a few decades down the line.
And the most chilling phrase from your paper conclusion says, additional challenges emerge as other changes in the climate system occur simultaneously. The interactions of these effects are complicated and may be different from anything humans have witnessed before. What do you mean different from anything humans have witnessed before?
I think that statement really means in recordable history, so certainly in at least the last few centuries for which we have reasonably reliable, well, not just instrumental records, but old diaries and whaling ships going up into the Arctic and so on, that the rate of change of climate in the Arctic is really something that was not predicted by computer model simulations just a couple of decades ago. So it really is a case where what we're seeing in the Arctic is really leading our understanding to helping us develop the models, because certainly these changes are at a faster rate than anyone or most people anticipated, say, 20 years ago.
We've been talking over one of the big questions for science and for those of us trapped here in the wild weather on the surface. Our guest is Dr. Edward Hanna. He's a professor of climate science and meteorology in the College of Science at the University of Lincoln in the UK. Edward, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
On another front, there's a dribble of better news for climate science coming out of the United States. Eric Roston from Bloomberg News reports, climate scientists exiled by Trump form panel to continue work. Scientists from a federal advisory committee demolished under Trump are self-organizing with help from Columbia University's Earth Institute. The shadow panel will be led by Richard Moss from the University of Maryland. The group will issue a report on the local impacts of a warming Earth, and it looks like New York State and the American Meteorological Society will help fund the venture. According to Roston's report, another nonprofit organization in Washington, Resources for the Future, will continue to compute a key indicator called the social cost of carbon. That includes health risks, coastal flooding losses, and many other factors to compute the true cost of carbon per ton. That's a figure that coal-boosting Trump did not want us to hear. Eric Roston writes, quote, "Before Trump took office, scientists raced to download and save scientific data from the Environmental Protection Agency and Department of Energy on fears the incoming administration would remove it or make it harder to access. The EPA itself eventually got in on the act, a permanent banner across the top of www.epa.gov, and an item at the bottom of the page links readers to the agency's site as it existed on January 19, 2017, the day before Trump took office. The banner shows not only have we properly archived Obama's EPA website, it's still accessible, EPA spokesman Jahan Wilcox said by email." That was a quote from Bloomberg News published January 4, 2018. As we've heard from both our guests today, a good deal of climate science will carry on as meteorology. Everyone, from corporations to insurance companies to agribusiness, they need fairly reliable weather forecasts. The military does too. Those predictions can no longer be made without knowing climate science and the expected impacts in a rapidly changing base climate. Keep an eye on the weather scientists, the meteorologists, to find more cutting-edge climate news. Other countries, especially France, are already recruiting and funding former American scientists. Germany has developed a very strong climate science program for many years. And I'm hearing more great science from Britain than ever before. Both countries are known as places where science of all kinds was born, and they haven't quit. Australian scientists are still contributing a lot despite discouragement and disbanding by their coal-loving government. Frankly, my own country, Canada, has not yet recovered from 10 years of climate repression by the former Harper government. It's pretty quiet here yet, and it takes a long time to get scientists developed and out there, except, of course, for Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa, who keeps pumping out those YouTube videos, paulbeckwith.net. The new stars of climate science are coming from China. Some Chinese scientists have been recruited by American universities, others remain on the mainland. But when I scan through important new climate science, time after time I am now finding Chinese authors as the lead authors. America's loss is becoming China's gain, but the world's science is becoming the winner. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening again this week. Let's keep going.